You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 185 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Action Comics number 1021, Detective Comics 1021, Far Sector number 5, Justice League Dark number 21, Wonder Woman 754, and Batman Curse of the White Knight number 8, the final chapter. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Warner Media has announced that DC Comics is donating $250,000 to the Book Industry Charitable Foundation, aimed at helping comic book stores and their employees. BINC is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to assisting booksellers in need, including comic book sellers. In the past, BINC has offered financial assistance to comic book stores affected by natural disasters and other unexpected financial crises. In addition, DC Chief Creative Officer and publisher Jim Lee will be auctioning off 60 original sketches of DC characters with the proceeds donated to support BINC's efforts.
That's phenomenal. I mean, I feel so terribly for all the small comic book stores that, I mean, I know I've read of several that have been forced to close. Yeah, anything that you can do to help them and keep them around, I think, is a good thing. So that's awesome. Good for DC.
Yeah, that's a... What's surprising, it's a big chunk of money for a company that's not putting hardly any books out right now. And kudos to them.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder if that money's not technically coming from DC and is coming from, you know,
the parent company.
Yeah. I would imagine, right?
Yeah, but, I would imagine so too.
But regardless, either way, it's great that some money's going towards helping keep at least some of the stores open, you know, long term.
Right.
After this all goes away. So, yeah, that's good. I mean, and I'm sure I don't have other examples, unfortunately, off the top of my head, but I'm sure other, you know, comic creators are doing stuff similar to what Jim Lee's doing. So that's awesome. Good for him.
Yep. All right. Up next for DC News, Logan Williams, a 16-year-old actor who appeared on the CW superhero series The Flash as a young Barry Allen, has died, according to his family. The actor's mother, Marlise Williams, confirmed the news of her son's death to the Tri-City News. No cause of death was provided, though Williams was said to have died suddenly on Thursday. Williams appears in 8 episodes of The Flash during its first 2 seasons. That's sad, dying at 16 years old.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tragedy. I feel truly terrible for his family. I mean, no family should have to go through.
Yeah.
Something like that. I mean, that's just my sincere condolences to that family. Obviously, I mean, my condolences mean nothing, but it's still, I mean, that's awful.
Yeah. In other DC news, Danielle Panabaker, who plays Killer Frost Caitlin Snow on the CW's The Flash, revealed the birth of her first child over the weekend. The actress and her husband and child are all happy, healthy, and back home to shelter in place amid the coronavirus pandemic that has the Flash series at a standstill. Okay, so I'm being overdramatic. I'm happy that the birth went okay and stuff. Kind of a crazy time to have a child.
It's got to be a scary time for a new parent. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, congratulations to that. I honestly didn't remember that she was pregnant.
I didn't either. And when I saw the news, I was like, "Did we cover this at all? I don't remember."
Either I've just been not paying attention, or they've done a really great job of hiding it on the show.
I haven't noticed.
So, yeah. So, I mean, in that regard, I mean, well done by the show. And then again, congratulations to her. That's, yeah, I honestly, yeah, when you told me the news before we started the podcast, I was like, wait, what? I remember Supergirl, the actress that plays Supergirl, Melissa Benoist, is pregnant, but I did not remember about Panabaker.
Right. And what's funny is I just added this to my DC news about 30 minutes ago. So that's when I saw it. Looking to see if there was any last minute DC news I had missed. And I came across that and I was like, oh, let me add this in there. All right. Up next for DC news, Titans season 3 will add a version of Barbara Gordon to its roster. According to Titans director, cinematographer Boris Wojcicki. Though he didn't specify whether she would appear as Batgirl, Oracle, or simply as herself. But Barbara Gordon will debut in the first episode of Season 3. That's kind of exciting. We've gotten Dick Grayson. We've gotten Jason Todd. Now we're getting Barbara Gordon. I've heard rumors of Tim Drake coming on the show. A lot of Batman representation on the Titans.
It is a very Batman-heavy show. But, I mean, what's new in regards to DC with that? That is exciting. I'm hopeful that it's the Batgirl version, although it was funny that your third option that you mentioned, that just Barbara Gordon, seems, given the show's history, by far the most likely option.
I hope not. I'd love to see Batgirl on there. If it was Oracle, I'd be okay with that too. So, but just a plain old Barbara Gordon would be kind of boring, but hey, that's just me. All right, up next for DC News, Stargirl creator Geoff Johns confirmed the presence of two key Justice Society members, Green Lantern and The Flash. With the Justice Society of America confirmed to play a major role in the Stargirl series, creator Geoff Johns has hinted at the presence of the two Golden Age team co-founders, Alan Scott and Jay Garrick. That's awesome.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty cool. I'm excited to see what that looks like, how often that they're going to be on the show. It'll be cool.
Yeah. I hope it's just
imagine they'll be probably periphery characters, but we'll see.
They'll be what?
Characters on the kind of like the periphery, like, not, you know, you don't see them that frequently.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering. I hope it's just, what I was getting ready to say was, I'm hoping it wasn't just a mentioning of their names. I'm hoping we actually see them.
My guess is we probably would see them. Maybe not necessarily in costume, or if we see them in costume, it's like one time. And yeah, that most of the time, if we ever see them, they're just in their civilian duds. But that's fairly typical for most of the shows anyway. So, yeah.
Or we get this blur going by. Well, there goes Jay Garrick.
Yeah. Or a green glow off screen.
Yeah.
It's Green Lantern. That's Alan Scott.
Yeah.
It's like, it would be like both of them would just be like season one Superman and Supergirl. Where you just see the cape. In the
Or you get a text from them. Oh, man. All right. And for a last bit of DC news, DC Stargirl star Breck Basinger says there have been talks of a crossover with The Flash. And here's a quote from her. There have been talks of Stargirl getting to go on an episode of The Flash and having a bigger storyline, but that didn't happen this season. But I just think that would be the coolest thing. So much of my family has watched Flash over the years. So there's talks of it. That would be exciting. And something I wouldn't be surprised Geoff Johns would be behind.
The only way I see that not happening is if Stargirl doesn't take off. You know what I mean?
Right.
As long as it's a successful show and it does keep its half CW, half streaming service status, there's no reason it won't. I mean, they film, to my knowledge, they film in Vancouver also, right?
I believe so.
I think they do. I mean, so I'll admit, that could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they film in the same place. So logistically, it's not the same issue that, like, Black Lightning, for example, best case scenario, he's only ever going to cross over during crossover season because they don't film in Vancouver. So I don't know. I'd be shocked if they don't cross over at some point, unless, like I said, the show is unsuccessful and gets canceled. I think that's really the only way.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I don't know about you, but I've been seeing an uptick in Stargirl advertising lately.
Yeah, and obviously they're just ads, so I can't, you know, make any definitive judgments off it, but it all looks pretty good from what I've seen. So I'd be surprised. The show would have to be, like, shockingly bad. Especially because CW, of all, I know it's weird because I don't know if they're technically, if they have any say in whether the show's life, you know, continues or not, but they're extremely slow to pull the plug on shows, so.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, it's not at all. I mean, realistically, a lot of networks would have canceled Legends after the first season. And I think they would have been justified in that, you know, based on the product that it turned out. But thankfully they didn't. And look at the show that we get now.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, long story short, I think it's inevitable that it crosses over with The Flash at some point.
All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie the Metal Geek, and I would like to invite you to hang out with myself and my fellow metal geeks as we have all kinds of discussions about heavy metal, films and TV shows, video games, theme parks, comic books, and whatever else is tickling our geeks. Please visit our website at metalgeekspodcast.com and follow us on all the social medias including Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Metal Geeks. We are also proud members of ESO Network, so you can check everything out at esonetwork.com. Keep it metal, keep it geeky, stay safe, and see you on the next episode.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. We've got spoilers,
spoilers
for you. We got spoilers,
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 spoilers.
We've got spoilers,
spoilers
for you,
for you.
All right, let's talk Action Comics 1021. So the issue opens up with the Justice League and the Young Justice defeated. Luthor is gloating, and we see Superman rages, which, honestly, Cletus, I thought was weird.
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, there's a lot weird in the comic, but yeah. Continue.
Before Superman can lay a hand on Luthor, the Red Cloud attacks to choke him. Connor Kent attacks Luthor, and the Legion of Doom steps in, attacking Connor. Superman convinces the Red Cloud that innocent lives are at stake and that a bus full of kids needs saving. We see the Red Cloud relents and rescues the kids. Next, Luthor orders the Legion of Doom to attack, but Leviathan whisks them away. And then Leviathan spends the next few pages explaining all the reasons why he couldn't kill the Legion of Doom and why Leviathan is better than the Justice League. Leviathan leaves the Justice League to clean up the mess in Metropolis on their own.
One thing I thought was there are several bullet points of things that I didn't get or didn't like in this comic, but I thought the biggest one that confused me was Leviathan's plan itself. What did they do? We know from, I think it's whatever, the miniseries that Bendis is doing, that they established some sort of city, right? But they implied in the miniseries that would be explained in this comic, and it was not explained at all.
No, Luthor said something about them taking control of Metropolis, but they don't. They, like, leave or something.
That was, I think, the weirdest thing was that there was, I know we read a comic, and I'm pretty sure it was the first issue of the miniseries that they're doing, where they said that whatever they had done in Metropolis would be explained in this comic, and that would mean it was not at all. He shows up, and it's weird because he says, like, we went and did it. We did the thing, and then it's like, but what did you do? But, like, I still don't remember, I guess.
I think they, I remember they established some sort of city, I think.
They bought a country. It was Markovia. Remember?
I thought they had done something actually in Metropolis, too.
They might have, but I don't remember.
We were told that this would be explained, and it wasn't. That was my other, you know, nitpicks with the comic aside. I think that was the most frustrating thing with this comic, is that it ultimately accomplished nothing. I mean, it didn't clarify what Leviathan did at all.
No.
That thought was the whole point of the comic.
Nope. And we don't see Super. And the other thing that was weird about this, this all happened before Superman's identity was revealed, it said.
Yeah, and of course, it also happened before Justice League. I mean, it's just so, the story is so out of place on the timeline. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's addressing stories that have all been published, even public comics by him, published for at least a month, at minimum.
It's been a few weeks since we talked about Leviathan Dawn number one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, just a weird, why this comic didn't come out 2 months ago, I'm not sure. It's just, I don't know, there was so much about it that just was really confusing and didn't make sense. I mean, that's, and then when you get into some of the actual plot of the comic, I personally didn't buy into Red Cloud's change of heart. It just felt like Deus Ex Machina, basically. Like, where did that come from? She's never shown any hint of humanity.
Yeah, so I don't know either, but it was weird. And then you have that scene at the end with Red Cloud and Ms. Leone. We're gonna make our move on Metropolis. Really?
But we see that crumble. We already see that crumbling underneath her in what's like current continuity, so to speak.
Yeah,
right?
We see that in Lois Lane, actually. I think of that series.
So I just. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get what, and in some of what Bendis is doing, like, I just didn't get this comic. It just doesn't, it feels out of place. It's going to be something that maybe reads better with a trade, but in a trade in which you also have access to other trades that this is referencing. It's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Detective Comics 1021. All right, well, this issue starts off similar to the last one, except instead of Harvey and Two-Face talking in a split page, it was Batman and Two-Face. And honestly, I thought it was a lot easier to read.
Yeah, it was, because you could read straight down on both. I think one thing that it's hard, I mean, because as any, I think any veteran comic book reader would read, and your inclination is still to go left to right. Honestly, any reader, your inclination is to go left to right. And so I like the creativity with it, but it's still like you have to basically reread part of it, because your natural inclination to go is, oh, is there sort of a call and response going on with the dialogues? And there's not.
No.
They're totally self-contained, and you just have to realize that at some point, which I think most people will. I don't know. I think there could be something you do artistically that draws your attention downward. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I guess, I mean, in a sense, you could argue they do that because the artwork is clearly separated. But, I mean, still your natural, I don't know. It's not really a complaint. It's just like something I think, I like the idea. I just think they could have done it in a way that guided you downward faster than what they have.
All right, well, we see Two-Face flips his coins and his followers go out to fight crime. It looked like they captured Catwoman and Penguin, but other villains they shot? I don't know, it was a little confusing. But Batman goes to the morgue to gather evidence and links them together. All had criminal records and all had some form of cancer. Batman leaves to go to the courthouse and Harvey is outside the Batcave. Harvey apparently knows that Bruce Wayne is Batman, but Two-Face does not. And he's struggling to contain control over Two-Face and pleads for Batman's help. Batman goes into the basement of the courthouse to find the Two-Face's new cult down there. And we see Two-Face regains control over Harvey and follows Batman into the basement where he shoots him. And then we're at the end of the issue. I gotta tell you, Cletus, I wasn't that impressed with this issue.
thought it was pretty bad. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I thought it was, I was just like, I don't remember the Two-Face, him knowing who Bruce is, but okay, that, whatever. I just probably don't remember that being a thing. But the whole idea of Dent knowing and Two-Face not knowing, how does that work? I don't remember them having so completely separate memories.
I don't either. I honestly, I think Tomasi is coming up with his own version of Two-Face. And it's not working that well, I don't think.
And then also just Batman just leaving him in the Batmobile? What?
I know, that's weird too.
I know he was cuffed, but I mean, still, what? I mean, come on. That was so, like, obviously flawed. That's something that would, like, Batman's not going to be like, oh, man, I shouldn't have done that. Like, he's Batman. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That would occur to him that would be a stupid idea. You telling me that he because that, what that implies is that he normally does that. That he goes and, like, arrests one of his, you know, one of his rogues gallery and just leaves him in the Batmobile while he goes off to do some other detective work. Then hops back in and takes him down to Arkham. Like, what?
Yeah,
that's not a thing. He doesn't do that.
No, it's not a police. It's not a police. It's not a police car.
I mean, for the most part, police don't even do that unless, like, extreme circumstances call for it. You know what I mean? Like, they don't throw somebody in the car and then go and continue their normal thing.
No, they don't.
And then when the time is right, like, it can happen, sure, but it's an extreme circumstance. That's not what happens in this comic. Batman basically just decides to, like, go get the groceries while he's out. Like, I'm not impressed by this storyline.
I'm not so either. Far. I'm not impressed with Tomasi's run so far. His Batman could be so much better. I don't know why his Superman title was so good and this one is Batman so poor. If he brought the family aspect to the Batman title he did to the Superman title, I think it would be really good. If he brought in some of the Bat family and did stories with them, I know Tomasi could tell some really good stories with the Bat family.
I'm actually really surprised that he hasn't had Damian be more of a focus in these comics, to be honest with you. Part of it almost makes me wonder if it's an editorial thing where it's, like, dictated that it needs to be Batman. It's just Batman. Because, like, we both know that he likes to write Damian. A lot. Like, he's done Batman comics before this. This is not the dude's first rodeo. I mean, he's written Damian a ton. And so the fact that Damian's not factored in almost at all in this run has been a little bizarre. It almost makes me wonder if it's not necessarily his choice.
Yeah, that would be my guess. One thing I did like in this issue was the artwork. I thought, especially the coloring, I thought some of the coloring was well done in this.
Yeah, I mean, I have no. I mean, the artwork was certainly better than Action Comics. So, no complaints there.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Far Sector number 5. So the issue opens up a week after the protest. We learn that the council issued an apology for ordering the CEPD to fire on unarmed protesters. We learned that 12 people had died, with another 33 people injured. And the council has accepted the protesters' demands and set a date for a referendum on the emotional exploit. Now, I got a question for you. Do you remember what our Green Lantern's name is?
No.
I can't either.
To be honest with you.
And I didn't see it throughout the issue. So I don't know, can't remember what her name is either. So I'm just going to call her our Lantern for the purpose of me going through this. So our Lantern grabs something to eat and then goes back to her office to do some investigating. And we see the AI offers to help her. Next, we get a flashback look into our Lantern's life. We see her as a young adult doing homework at the table. Her parents are off talking, and the mother gets passed up for a promotion by an incompetent white male when she had already been doing the job. We see another panel with the parents fighting, and then another panel after that where they're divorced. We see our Lantern walking out with her father out of the divorce court, and I'm assuming he got the custody of the kids from that panel. I'm just assuming that. The next panel, we see 9/11 happen, and we see the Twin Towers are on fire. Our Lantern and her father are helping with the rescue efforts. Next, we see our Lantern graduates from high school. She joins the military and looks like she's fighting in Desert Storm. After that, she goes to Princeton, and then...
Well, it wouldn't be Desert. It would be the Iraq invasion.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry. Just...
I can't remember the timeline of all this. All right. After that, after she's out of the military, we see she goes to Princeton. And then after that, she joins the police force, which I'm guessing is NYPD. Doesn't state, but I'm just guessing.
I think that's a pretty solid guess.
We see that her partner uses excessive force, and then when she reports it, she gets fired. So that leaves our Lantern in a bar drinking, and we see a bald black woman show up at the bar. Our Lantern thinks that she's trying to pick her up, but in reality, she wants to give her a job. And, of course, the lady is wearing a green outfit and a cape with a Green Lantern emblem on it. And the thing I thought was odd, as this lady taller than our Lantern when they were walking down the street, but by the end of the conversation, the bald lady was shorter and she was blue. Was this a guardian in disguise?
The implication seemed to strongly suggest that it was indeed a guardian.
But you notice how she was taller, and then as they got to the end of the conversation, she was short, and she was blue looking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a really interesting twist, to be honest, because I think you and I both assumed it was some sort of nefarious thing, right? I mean, I thought that's what the comic was trying to insinuate, and then we find out, in all likelihood, it was a guardian
right.
that gave her the ring. And so that's... I was very, very intrigued by that.
I was too. And I reread that twice. And I'm looking at the panels. I'm like, wait a minute. When we got into the end here, she's blue. But back here, she's not. And she's taller. And I was like, interesting. So I'm more intrigued to find out. I hope we get to learn more about this Guardian and what their purpose was. I'm guessing we will at some point during the series.
We certainly will. You can't tease the secret behind her ring and then not address that. That would be deeply unsatisfying.
Yeah.
And nothing what we've read in the comics suggests that they would be silly enough to do that. So this continues to be a really good comic. I am so intrigued by the character, by her the backstory with how she got the ring. And then just the world that she's on now in policing, I think is such a, they've built such an interesting world in only 5 issues.
Yeah.
It when you read a comic like this, it's what frustrates me when you read other comics that spend so long on setup. And it's like, look, you can tell an interesting story and build a world in 5 issues. Look at what Far Sector did. You know what I mean? And then we get these other comics that like spin their wheels for 6 issues just to set up the main purpose of the story.
Yeah, Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't even the comic I was thinking of, but that's exactly my point. It's like, Bendis is a good writer. Bendis should be able to, that shouldn't be hard for him to do. Yeah, I don't know. This is a great comic, and I really strongly suggest people check it out. If you like Green Lantern, if Grant Morrison's Green Lantern is not doing it for you because it's too weird, or if you just want more, you got to check out Far Sector. I mean, it's a great book.
It is a great book. And I'm happy DC's letting it happen. What I'm curious about is, it's interesting that a Guardian would pick somebody from Earth to come deal with this so far away from everything.
I'm wondering if it's some sort of trial thing. You know what I mean? Where they're like, maybe this is an unsanctioned ring and the Guardian is like, behind the backs of the council testing this ring out to see if this idea works. You know what I mean? So it's like a new way to handle how the Green Lanterns work. Or is it somebody that used to be a Guardian and is no longer part of the Guardians? Is still Owen, right? But isn't on the council and still, believes that it's, I don't know. There's so many interesting ways to go with it.
This could be a big experiment thing too.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, and maybe the Owen lady really is nefarious after all. And so, like I said, I'm super intrigued by that, but at the same time, I'm also intrigued by the main story happening on the alien world. Like, I think it's got two really interesting stories going on at once.
Yeah, I agree. And unfortunately, it's with this being the second week DC hasn't released any comics, we might not be seeing any more for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, that is a bummer. I don't know how this series is going to end, but I would love to see. I feel like Green Lantern is one of those characters that would really benefit from a different character getting a miniseries. You know what I mean? Like, I do think, I obviously being a Green Lantern fan, I do think that like somebody, Green Lantern is big enough to deserve a consistent ongoing. But I think if you do things like this far sector, like what if you did a different one, but it's Jessica, or another one and it's Baz, who's, you know, been MIA for a year. I think there's some interesting things you could do.
They could do miniseries with some of the other characters too. John Stewart, Guy Gardner, Kyle. I mean, they always use Hal Jordan, but it'd be interesting to see some of these other Lanterns doing stuff. And it doesn't have to be, they could be off on their own doing their own missions, non-connected. So, yeah, I would love to see that.
I think it would. The Far Sector reminds me a little bit of a book. I know I always reference him, but Tom King did a book, The Omega Man. I've talked about it before. But Kyle Gardner is a White Lantern in that book. But, I mean, part of it is basically it's like Far Sector in that Kyle is called in to, you know, basically police the, like, you know, bring order to the sector and sort things out. And the whole story is based essentially that one mission. And obviously a lot of different stuff happens, but there are a lot of interesting parallels between the two. And I think there's a lot of potential for that to just have, because I think the problem with, because Johns's run is so great, right?
Right.
And but it got so cosmic that I think a lot of other writers following Vendetti got caught up in trying to match that. And they overlook the fact that John's built up to that. Like, one of the early stories in that is him and is Hal Jordan and Oliver on Earth fighting a Black Mercy plant with Mogul. You know, yeah. Like, it started small and there were these small missions, and even the big stories that established these big parts of the Green Lantern mythos, the modern mythos, were individual Hal Jordan missions. Like, when he finds Larfleeze, that's a single mission. I mean, it's spread over 6 issues, but it's still ultimately, and it builds into Blackest Night, but it's still just Hal Jordan going on and completing a mission.
Right.
And I think some writers that have followed up have kind of missed that, and it turns into, like, they start it trying to be a mission, then it just turns into, like, you know, too big. It gets too big. I thought we got that a little bit with Baz and Jessica's run, where it started out small, and the next thing you knew, it was like the fate of the whole Earth within the same arc. And I think you could really focus on what a Green Lantern is, so to speak, really well. They're a policeman. They're an intergalactic policeman. If you just have it basically, if the miniseries is just like one day on the beat, so to speak, I think it would allow a little bit more focus, and you're not weighted down by needing to tell a story that's going to take 50 issues to tell and laying the groundwork for those 50 issues.
Right. And the other thing that John's had going for him is there was another series at the time called Tales of the Core, which featured other Green Lanterns besides Hal, that was also building that same story. It was all built. They were both series were building together to tell John's story.
Right. Yeah. And I think he had a pretty heavy say in how that was being written. And that's obviously not been the case since then. So we've gotten Green Lantern stuff where one book is doing one thing and another book is almost directly, you know, contradicting that.
Yeah.
Or they're just not on the same page at all. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, that was one of the reasons it was so successful, because Green Lantern Corps was telling the story of the core as a whole, and then you're getting the big picture stuff a lot of times with whatever Hal was up to. But Johns was pretty clearly tightly running both books, even though he wasn't writing the other book, it was very clearly, you know, doing what he wanted it to do.
Right. And they were obviously working very closely together to tell the story, the overall story, which is a great story.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I think Far Sector is a great example of the kind of books that we could see other Green Lantern books doing. I mean, like I said, I have no idea how this story will end, so I don't know if that's the end of this character. I mean, at this point, I'd happily read another one, which is her. I'd read Far Sector 2, happily. But I would also love to see other Green Lantern miniseries. Guy Gardner, like, you know, when's the last time he's popped up? Kyle Rayner, I can't remember when was the last time we read something with him?
It's been a while.
It's been quite a bit. John Stewart, luckily, has been the Justice League Green Lantern, which is awesome, which is great. So he's gotten a focus. And then obviously Grant is using Hal, you know, but then where's Baz? You know, where's Guy Gardner?
Right.
Kyle Rayner.
Jessica's in Odyssey.
Which, I mean, how many people are even reading? And also, it's not even really a green. Like, it's awesome that she's in a book. I'm not going to complain about that. But, I mean, you'll be hard-pressed to call it a Green Lantern book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, shoot, for most of it, she hasn't been able to use her ring because it was out of charge.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. She's been a Green Lantern intermittently, I would say, in the comic. So, yeah, I think it would be a great way, because they've introduced all of these, they've kind of opened Pandora's box a long time ago. There are so many Earth Lanterns now. I mean, one of the problems with that is then you inevitably just have guys out of the rotation. But I think miniseries would be the way to kind of do something with that, do something about that, and have the other Lanterns, you know, be up to something and not just be not in print.
Right. I agree with you on that. And DC's been doing some pretty good miniseries lately. So, all right. Before we move on to our next title for this week, let's take a short break.
Are you one of millions of people worldwide with compulsive geekiness, feeling isolated and alone? Do you wish there were people that understood the thoughts and feelings associated with geeky flare-up? There is hope and a treatment program that can help. Ask your podcast service or ESO network provider if the Nerd Bliss podcast is right for you, or go to nerdblisspodcast.com today. Side effects may include butt hurt, movie quotes, nostalgia, warp speed, becoming verklempt, becoming a brony, appreciation of Cats the movie, pantyhose, asking God what he needs with a starship, donut muffin or bagel, fat shoelaces, improved sense of rhythm, aiming to misbehave, nudity, and random arbitrary lists.
And we're back. Let's talk Justice League Dark number 21. So, John Constantine and Zatanna go to Luton Reformatory in Virginia looking for Abigail Arcane, the avatar of the Rot. Zatanna battles off the Rot monsters as John searches for Abigail. While waiting for John, Anton Arcane shows up. The situation is getting worse in Los Angeles for Detective Chimp, Wonder Woman, and Animal Man as more and more people are infected by the Mushroom Heads. I call them the Mushroom Heads. And then we see Ken is back at the Justice League Dark headquarters holding Floronic Man captive. There's a lot of action in this book and not moving the story forward too much, but it was all interesting. It wasn't boring at all.
No, I thought this was another great one. I mean, it is admittedly still trying. It seems like it's still trying to kind of set the stage for something, which appears to be Anton Arcane popping up as a villain, which I think is not a surprise, but it is pretty cool. And I've mentioned this before when we were reviewing Swamp Thing, the show, for people who don't know, I would argue that Arcane is like the classic Swamp Thing villain. So we're getting sort of an arch nemesis here. I still think it's really cool that we're getting Animal Man. I kind of hope he sticks around, because that's a fringe DC character that does definitely belong with the Magical team. And I wouldn't be upset if he stuck around on the team for longer than this story.
Yeah, and it looks like they're setting up for, I'm guessing, well, we know Swamp Thing's going to be coming back. And I'm guessing Abigail is going to get redeemed and Anton or Kane's going to be the avatar for the Rot again. That's what I'm guessing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I see the thing I can't say for sure. I don't know because I haven't read a lot of the new Swamp Thing stuff. I don't know necessarily that Abigail Arcane was a villainous avatar of the Rot, if that makes sense.
She might not be.
She might not have been. And I don't know. So I can't say for sure one way or the other. So it may be a thing where, like, clearly Daddy Arcane is would be very bad as the avatar of the Rot. And so it could be a matter of, like, him seizing it temporarily and them fighting to get, you know, Abby back as the avatar. I don't know. We'll be curious to see where the story goes.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Wonder Woman number 754. After I read this issue, I went back and I looked up pre-Flash Maxima, and she has been both a villain and a hero. And I was right. She originally came to Earth wanting to take Superman as a mate, and he rejected her, of course. And she later on became a member of the Justice League and helped battle against Doomsday. Her first appearance was in Action Comics 645, which was September 1989. I was a sophomore in high school. And Maxima was created by Roger Stern and George Perez.
That's funny because the concept of her seems more antiquated than that. You know what I'm saying? It almost, I don't know. It felt like when you were telling me her backstory and then just fitting in with what we read in this comic, doesn't it just feel like a really old school kind of character?
Oh, you mean in the Wonder Woman comic?
Yeah.
I don't know. This because
I know I totally believe you. I understand that she is from the 80s, but just like the whole concept of the characters feels older than that.
Because what was weird to me was the version of Maxima in this Wonder Woman title, she felt more feminine, weaker, and not as powerful as the one I remember from the 80s. The one from the 80s, she was a tough warrior woman and didn't take crap from nobody. She was as tough as Superman, and she could hold her own. This version we had in Wonder Woman, I didn't get that vibe from her.
I mean, I think the writers were probably going for something different from the character, to say the least.
They probably were. The other thing that's different is obviously she's a lesbian in this one, but I mean that doesn't have to change her character type from the 80s, but she didn't feel like the same character to me.
No, and I think part of that is I suspect that I don't want to speak because like I know this is speculation. I suspect that she was supposed to be a representation of feminist ideas when she was originally written. And I assume that what Orlando is trying to do is still uphold that, but maybe like update those to be in line with what I would say most people would think those viewpoints would be at this point. You know what I mean? Like it's still right. The same. Like he's trying to stay true to the idea of the character while updating, you know, what she actually is doing. And again, I want to be very clear. That is speculation. I don't want to pretend like I'm speaking from a place of knowledge. That's just what I gathered reading the comic.
All right.
I mean, she's very clear. I mean, the comic is not subtle in regards to being about, you know, female empowerment in that regard.
Right. So Maxima comes to Wonder Woman for help because her betrothed sent assassins after her. Prince Ultra hates Maxima because she does not want to give her heart to men. Also, Maxima has discovered the truth that the original rulers were two women, not a man and a woman. And Maxima has proof. We also see the invisible jet is now a spaceship. Nice upgrade, Wonder Woman.
That was pretty cool. I'm not going to lie.
That was cool. And then at the end of the issue, we see the horsewomen have found another to join their ranks, Genocide.
I thought this was, I know that there's definitely going to be a lot of people that will roll their eyes at this comic, and that's fair. I thought it was, honestly, it was fairly true to old school Wonder Woman. Like, Golden Age Wonder Woman was very in your face about its feminist ideals. Like, it was not a subtle comic. And it has very frequently not been throughout its history as a comic. But, like, I think it's fair that that might be off-putting to some people. But I do, to Orlando's credit, I think that is very true to old-school Wonder. And that's sort of what I meant by this comic felt old-school in that regard. Like, it's really that, like, there was just no subtlety to it, right? I mean, it was it was so out in the open, very in your face about the idea and the message it was trying to send. And yeah, whether you like that or not is fine. I can't imagine you're reading Wonder Woman if you don't like that. But to Orlando's credit, I think that is how Wonder Woman was like originally written. Those William Marsden comics are not subtle, like I said. So I don't know. I thought it was interesting. The nitpick I would have had with this plot was the weird interlude we had with Donna Troy. I thought that was confusing to me. Not because it was just like, it was kind of didn't have a place in the comic. It kind of came out of nowhere and then obviously wasn't resolved because he's just trying to tease something with her. But I don't know. It didn't really fit with the rest of the book.
I have to agree with you on that. It felt like he was bringing something that happened to Donna Troy in another book somewhere. Something happened to her, and now Wonder Woman's going to be dealing with it, but they've just been hinting at it. They haven't got to the story yet.
And see, I guess I get that. We've been praising other comics for teasing other stories, but like, let's use Fart Sector as an example of this, which is obviously trying to tell two different stories at once. It's committing the time to doing them. You know what I mean? It's not just these weird little, they fit into the story. And whereas this one, I feel like the Donna Troy thing just is just in there, right? He's telling the Maxima story. He pauses, throws in Donna Troy with no segue or explanation, and then jumps right back to Maxima with no segue. I mean, that's a huge difference between that, trying to tell two stories, and what Far Sector is doing, where, you know, something reminds our character of what happened to her in the past, or, you know, something happens and it suggests what's going on with how she got the ring. But, you know, there's a difference in storytelling there.
Yeah. And one's definitely better than the other.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah.
So it looks like to me that we're moving on to the Horsewoman next issue.
I hope so. I'm a little bit frustrated with Orlando with is like, just tell your damn story, dude. Like, if you want to tell this Horsewoman story, that's fine. Can you just do it? Just tell the story.
He's like building for it, but we don't really need to be building towards it. I mean,
the problem is he's building towards it while he's telling like these filler stories. You know what I mean? Like, it's not. We were talking about Johns' Green Lantern run, and he obviously, one of the huge things with that run was hitting at big things yet to come, but they like fit into the story that he was doing. I don't know. There was a way, like, the story that was happening ultimately was building towards the big thing that he was hinting at. They were connected together. Whereas this is like, Maxima's not going to have anything to do with this. I mean, maybe she comes back and helps Wonder Woman, but that's coincidental.
Yeah. It's not like Wonder Woman has been battling or dealing with something one of these horsewomen have been doing. That'd be building for the story.
That would be interesting. Or like she's following, like she's always one step behind them. Like she keeps cleaning up the aftermath. And it's like, what is going on? Where, like, what's happening? And then we see the villains, you know, one step ahead of her gathering this team. And we see her slowly trying to catch up. And then that comes to a head, and then that's the comic. Like, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
And again, the comic, the story that he wants to tell with them could be good. I tell it already.
And hopefully he does.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to our last title for this week. Batman, Curse of the White Knight, number 8. And the one I've been waiting to talk about all day. So the issue opens up with Batman and the GTO in pursuit of Azrael, who's swinging on the rooftops. As soon as Azrael lands, Batman disables the GTO vehicles of the other heroes so he can go after Azrael alone. Typical Batman. Batman has one goal, kill Azrael. We see him use machine guns on the Batmobile, snag Azrael with a bat hook, and tries burning him with the Batmobile's engine. We even see Batman fire some sort of assault rifle at Azrael, who points out that Batman doesn't kill, and tries to tell them that they're the same. We see Nightwing shows up and rams Azrael with his car, and Azrael escapes, but Dick talks some sense into Bruce. We see Azrael steals a Coast Guard helicopter because he wants to blow up the dam and flood Gotham. Batman returns to Wayne Manor, grabs two swords from the plaque on his wall, and he turns the Batmobile into a boat and is able to destroy the helicopter before Azrael can destroy the dam. Batman uses Azrael's religion against him and reminds Azrael that his sword's name is God's Will, and that's all he should need. And then we get a sword battle between the two. Batman is able to trap Azrael's helmet in his Batmobile shields, forcing Azrael to take off his helmet and drop his sword. Batman takes the sword and slices Azrael's throat. Then we see Batman grabs the first aid kit, sews up Azrael's wound, and basically leaves him for the police. We get the last bit of the Azrael story as we learn that Edmund Wayne's daughter was born to a prostitute after his death. The last night of St. Dumas took her away from Gotham and hid her within the protective order away from the Bakers. And her last name was changed to Valley, a reminder of her birthright, Gotham Valley. We see Bruce Wayne surrenders himself to the GCPD. We see Harley comes to rescue him, but Bruce tells her, no, I need to do this. And yes, we see they're definitely in love as we see that hand scene with the, yeah, with the heart in the rain. Bruce's fortune is given away. We see Wayne Enterprises is being restructured, and many of its subsidiaries are turned into nonprofits. We see a large portion of the money has been donated to the GCPD, where it will be used to give the police some badly needed upgrades, and also a new fleet of specialized vehicles, unofficially called Batmobiles. And it looks like they're planning on rebuilding and expanding the GTO, with their newly promoted Sergeant Bullock has announced he's going to recruit more vigilantes. I thought that was funny he was put in charge of the GTO. We see Bruce Wayne is now awaiting trial, and Commissioner Montoya needed someone to keep an eye on him so he won't escape from jail. And that person is Jason Todd. And I did not feel like this was the end of the issue either, or the end of the story. He kind of hinted at the trial of Bruce Wayne coming up. What's your thoughts on that?
It definitely feels like we're going to get a part three, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I was pretty freaking excited about that, I'm not gonna lie.
I was too. I saw that. I was like, ooh, there's gonna be a part three. He left it wide open.
Oh man, we've both been pretty open about being very okay with getting a part three of this. So that was unexpected, but really exciting, especially because I'm pretty sure they've hinted strongly that Jason's thought to be dead, right?
Yeah, and it was very odd because it seemed like Bruce was the one that asked Montoya to have him come there. He was wearing some sort of, I didn't know, it was a police uniform, but I wasn't sure if it was a military police or if it was something else. I wasn't sure
who he was representing. It seemed military. It definitely looked like it was military.
That's what I thought, too. Very interesting. I was very surprised to see Jason Todd. He definitely left it wide open for another story.
Yeah.
And I guess now we're just waiting for an announcement.
Well, yeah, and I think we talked about this. He is doing, we know for sure he's doing some miniseries that I think are in the world but aren't necessarily by him that he was overseeing. And so he's kind of building this whole, you know, White Knight world. And I thought that maybe we'd have to be satisfied with whatever these fill-in stories were, but it looks like we're going to get another one, which is I'm excited for it because, in my opinion, both of these have been very good. I have very much enjoyed both of them.
Yeah. How did you think this ended?
I thought it ended well. I mean, I think as best. I mean, had Bruce actually killed Asriel, I would not have liked it that much, to be honest with you. What I really liked was, it is obviously a really new and different take on Batman. I mean, he's exploring other like old storylines, but these are very new things to do, I think, in some ways with Batman. But he's still staying true to the character, and I think that's one of the reasons why the books work, is because, yeah, we had a story where Joker was effectively the hero and Batman wasn't. And yes, we had a story where Bruce exposes his identity and retires, but at the same time, he never got away from the core, you know?
Right.
We got that. I loved the scene. The scene when, like, you see the internal thought process with Bruce where he gets the memories of different people, like Alfred reminding him of what a good person he can be and the hero he can be. I loved that whole, that four-panel sequence was phenomenal. And I thought it was like, in case you were reading this worried that he was really going to cross that line and kill, it was, I thought, Murphy's way of being like, no, I get it. I understand who Batman is. And I thought it ended well. I was very happy with the way this comic concluded, especially because we're going to get another part.
I know. It's not confirmed yet, but it's pretty obvious.
The only reason it would go that way is if he decided to not follow up on it for some reason.
Yeah.
You know it's selling well. Otherwise, they wouldn't want to build a world around it anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
So the ball has got to be in his court, and he seems to really like it. He's done two series already and willingly wrote that part in. So,
yeah, I thought it was a good ending too. And it definitely left me wanting more. All right. Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Jamie, shout outs, Cletus.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's going to be the first White Knight, Batman White Knight, just because it was Curse of the White Knight, I think, was phenomenal. I think it was a really interesting take on the Asriel story. I don't think that Murphy would be shy about it. He's clearly referencing, you know, that classic storyline with what is his stuff, but he does it in his own way, and it builds so well on the first book. This world that he's building, I think, is just phenomenal. And if you haven't read Batman White Knight, I strongly recommend it, because like this one with Asriel, the first one does something really interesting with Joker, and it's something that we have maybe seen sometimes, but not really. He really does something, for the most part, is pretty unique with the Joker.
All right, and for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about Batman the Court of Owls, because I finally read it. It's freaking awesome.
That's great.
Yes, I read The Court of Owls, and I've already started The City of Owls. So I read it in a day, so if that tells you anything.
What'd you think?
Oh, I loved it. It's very interesting. I thought it was well written. It feels epic without trying to be epic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well written and well drawn. I love the artwork, too. I highly recommend this story.
Yeah, I second that. I'm glad you finally checked it out. It's a great book. And I think you said it really well. Snyder does not try too hard in that Court of Owls, City of Owls arc. He's not trying too hard to make it epic. It just is. It is a good story and a memorable story.
And I'm happy he's bringing the Bat family into it too. So I'm very excited to see what happens. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. All right, well, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. Coming up next week, I have no clue what we're going to be talking about next. We're going to go on hiatus. Please, you're going to have to talk about that, because there's no new comics, there's no new shows. So we're either going to have to regurgitate something or talk about something we haven't talked about before. I don't know. Honestly, don't know what we're going to do. So stay tuned. Stay safe. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go. You sure this is necessary? The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.